Welcome to the New Books Network.
This is the day we met. You were down by the surf. I could just make you out in the distance. I remember being drawn to you even then. I thought, wow, how odd. I'm drawn to someone's back. You were in that orange sweatshirt that I would come to know so well and even hate eventually. At the time, I thought, how cool. Orange sweatshirt.
Hi there.
Hi.
I saw you sitting over here by yourself. And I thought, thank God, someone normal who doesn't know how to interact with these things either.
Yeah. I don't ever know what to say.
I'm Clementine. Can I borrow a piece of your chicken?
And then you just took it. Without waiting for an answer.
Hi, I'm Dan.
And I'm Mike.
So welcome to 15 Minute Film Fanatics. You know how this podcast works. Mike and I, lifelong friends, we watch movies separately. We talk about them on the show for the first time. Today we're doing a movie that, when I suggested it, Mike texted me and said, how have we never talked about this movie? I don't know. It's been around forever. We both love this movie, but now we're going to have a conversation about it. What are we doing today, Mike?
Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
2004, directed by Michel Gondry, with a screenplay by Charlie Kaufman, who's great. And it reminds me we have to do some of his other movies too. So in part one, we always talk about our overall take on the movie or what stuck out to us this time when we rewatched it. Mike, what do you think?
I watch this movie too often. I got to know what you think first.
All right, here's what I think. I rewatch this movie. The first thing you think is what happened to Jim Carrey. And I don't know what happened to his career. And I'm sure there's somebody out there that knows, but he's really, really terrific in this movie, just like everybody else is. I love this movie that it's a complete imagining and dramatization of an idea, right? What if you could make your wish to forget a painful experience or person come true? Like, that's a very simple question. What if you could erase it and make a lacune, a gap in your person? What would that look like? So not only is it great for that reason, but what I really like about this movie is it takes that mechanism and that plot idea and then does it, but then it actually makes a story around it. It puts a mistake in it. Not a mistake in the writing, but a mistake in the actual humans doing it, because Mark Ruffalo isn't paying attention to Jim Carrey when he's in his apartment, and Jim Carrey halfway through the procedure says, no, don't do it. So I think a quote-unquote regular movie would have shown you what happens, and here's what happens when you get done, and here's what the people are like. But this movie's like, no, all kinds of people get it done. Everybody's going to that terribly paneled office in the strip mall with their box of stuff and the dog toys and stuff to get this done. What would happen if it didn't work for somebody? And so the movie establishes all these rules, but then breaks one of them. And that's what makes it totally unique. That's why I like it better than a movie like Inception, where you get all these rules and here's how this dream works and here's what you do. Because this movie it's human, it's funny, it's sad, it's interesting. And I think that there's a real human quality. And we'll talk about the humans in a little bit, but that's my overall take. That's what I really like about it.
Yeah, first, I can't believe this movie is two decades old. Second is, I was going to say, I don't mean to knock Christopher Nolan, but Inception took him 3 hours to explain. 3 hours to explain. And the reason it took 3 hours to explain is for the reason that you just mentioned, which is he has to show you how it works, and then he has to show you how it doesn't work. And this movie condenses it working and not working into one single thing and uses the complications from that to drive the plot, which also help you understand its structure, which means we'll get into this with my moment, which means he can show you things and bring poignancy to things the first time that have the poignancy of the last time, because of course the first time for any experience is always the last time, but that's not how we feel in our heads, because that's not how we live. And I think that it's the exposition here as well is wonderfully condensed. I'm sure it took a lot of work to get those kinds of structures. I mean, I talk to a lot of people that do not like this movie, and they say, well, I expected a love, romance, comedy, and it's weird. And it's like, well, it's by Charlie Kaufman.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Don't walk into a pizzeria if you don't want pizza. Like, that's Charlie Kaufman's brand. And this is totally on brand for everything that he does.
Totally.
And everything that he's done in his career.
But I think it does have all those things that it, like, you do. And, you know,
it does.
It does. And I think what you said of the exposition is true, because I also enjoyed, because I forgot a lot of the nuts and bolts of it because I hadn't seen that in a long time. I forgot how great it is when, like, you realize the first scene when they're on the train and he doesn't know the song Clementine. He doesn't know who Huckleberry Hound is. You realize that, oh, okay. You realize what's really going on is that he's post-processed there. And he doesn't remember her. So it does all those things where it gives you the information without being cute. It's not like, you know, here it is. You ready? Get ready, Mike. You ready for this? This movie could have fallen under a mountain of red arrows. This movie could have fallen under a mountain of red arrows as we talk about red arrow videos where you could put on YouTube and say, see, this is the part because really Jim Carrey doesn't really remember when she came by. Like, okay, I get it. But it does that without just being clinical and cold. That's what I think Inception is. Inception is this beautifully worked out calculus equation, but there's no people in it. This one is actually about people.
I think that you like this movie. I think people like this movie the most, say, before they're 25 or after they're 40.
Guilty.
And one of the reasons that that's the case,
that's totally true.
And when I was in college, that this was like the greatest college movie ever, was because part of the lesson here is again, this is not the metaphor of falling in love with the same person over and over again. Is if you do fall in love with the wrong person, you will fall in love with the same person over and over and over and over again. But the brilliant thing that they do is they make that one person Kate Winslet.
This is such a good college movie because you admire it for its craftiness, not for its craft, but for its craftiness. You admire it for its cleverness. And you think, well, and then when you're older, you look at these people, because this is the reaction I had this time. You know, when he sees her the first time in the diner, right? She screams out, I am trouble. I am big time trouble. When she's pouring that gin into her morning coffee, everything about her screams, stay as far away from me as you can. No older person who's been through a few relationships would say, no, I think Clementine's a good catch. I you'd stay away from her, right? She gets away with it because she's cute.
In college, you say, wow, she's so beautifully quirky.
Yeah, what a free spirit.
And then when you're over 40 and you watch this movie, you're like, Tom Wilkinson is a great actor. Like, whatever happened to that guy?
Exactly.
Revisiting the movie, what makes it age so well, I think, is revisiting the movie. Is it works like the memories, and you're like, it's the same movie, but it's a totally different movie.
100%. If you were 20 years old, you would think that Clementine was a real catch. You know, and that's why it's so great that Elijah Wood is so pathetic. They're all kind of pathetic. He's like, oh, I'll come over and help you feel better. And she's like, we have to go to Montauk right now, or we have to go to Boston. She says, let's go to Boston right now. Oh, okay. Like, he's so awful, but because he's so weak. And I think that the movie, if you're older, you think about these people differently. For example, like Jim Carrey is he's pathetic. His character is pathetic in the literal sense of the word. Like, I wouldn't want to be anything like him. You wouldn't want to hang out with him. He's a mess. But when you're younger, I think you see these people in a different light. So that's a great point, is that our memories are affected by our experiences. And when you're older in life, your experiences of watching a movie like this is you start to think, yeah, I got a couple people I'd like to erase, but you think about them differently.
And that, so it plays back into the mechanism of the film, because imagine you were 40. And you were in pain and you're like, you know what would make me feel better? Instead of facing all that, what I'll do is I'll erase everything from between 25 to 40. And you're like, well, you're not 40 because you're 40. You're 40 because you've accumulated 40.
Right.
So if you subtract 15, guess what you're going to be?
Right.
And so that, right. I think the movie never buys into Lacuna as a solution to any problems. In fact, it loves the problems that it creates, because that's what makes it such a brilliant movie. And I think, you know, we'll talk about the ending more, but the ending would be like if you managed to block out everything that happened between 25 and 40, and then somebody mailed you the intervening 15 years and you were like, oh my God.
Well, of course, 40 is a number of, it's a biological statistic, but it's also an emotional shorthand, right? Because you know people that might be 35, but they have the souls of older people, and vice versa, right? So Lacuna doesn't really care about that. Lacuna, I think, is a money-making thing. It's exactly like Dr. Now's office and, like, you know, My 600-Pound Life. Like, it's just there to make, because Tom Wilkinson figured something out, but it doesn't give you counseling about what you're supposed to do after you have somebody erased.
But that's why I think the movie only works if he's in it, because you need one older man who also has, you find out that he's erased the intervening years. He's really 25. He's screwing up a marriage. One thing that I think movies about young relationships don't do well is they focus on the damage that's done to one person. But what's beautiful about this is that relationship damages Mary.
Yes.
And that, but you can't dramatize that well between Joel and Clementine, because they're like, she's trouble and he's a loser. So it's like, who's damaging who? It's like, well, what if you tore apart a decades long relationship and bruise somebody so that they're going to make the same exact mistakes that you did? And you look like a 60-year-old man, but inside you are Elijah Wood.
Yeah, because we see Jim Carrey and Kate Winslet walking on ice. And that's obviously what the relationship's like. They're walking on, on ice. But it turns out that everybody's walking on ice, because you can fall into those memories at any moment. So the question of the movie is, wouldn't it be great if you weren't walking on ice, you're walking on cement?
But if you were, would that still be life? So the point, I think that's part of the beauty of the movie, is that you can't escape from it. And even if you try, it creates another version of itself, because this is what being alive is like. And there's really no way out.
Welcome back. In part two, we like to talk about our favorite moments, or moments that upon a rewatching really stood out to us. So, Mike, what do you got?
Well, now that we've torn down the two main characters that make this movie work emotionally, I will say that they are, in their sense, unbelievably relatable. I think that there's something about, and it's got to be in the performances, it's not just necessarily in the writing, there is something about Clementine as a character on paper versus how she's played by Kate Winslet. And there is something deeply unlikable about Joel. It's hard to imagine anybody wanting to be around Joel, but there's something about the way that he's played by Jim Carrey that you can draw yourself on it. And I think that that's wonderfully dramatized in the moment. He revisits the first moment that they ever met on the beach, but it's one of the last things to go. And so again, the beginning is the end. The first time is always the last time, but experientially it's not. And so there's a difference between the way time works in my sensibility of it versus the way that it works objectively. And they're sitting next to each other, and she tries to, he's narrating it to himself like it's a nature documentary. That's the first time I saw you. You were in that orange sweatshirt that I would eventually, know and then come to hate. And she sits next to him and she says, I saw you sitting up here by yourself, and I thought to myself, thank God, another normal person who doesn't know how to behave or talk to anybody at these kinds of events. And there's something in that where it is sort of pathetic, and it is sort of eye-rolly, but she makes it work, and she's trying to dramatize or explain why one person is drawn to another. But it works in the sense that we are drawn to other people because we're not drawn to people.
What do you mean by that?
Right. That's what makes being drawn to somebody is necessarily because you're not drawn to other people. And I think it's dramatized so well in that moment, right? I want to come sit here by you because you're showing me alienation, and I feel alienated, and I'm not drawn to whatever's going on here. So again, like, on paper, there are many things wrong with that line. I'll explain. If a friend came to you and said, I just met a girl, you'll never believe what she said to me, you'd be like, I'm not sure about that, But in this movie, when she's played by Kate Winslet and he's played by Jim Carrey, that it totally works. And what it's trying to dramatize is you have an initial feeling, I think, when you're drawn to other people, which is like, please be weird or socially awkward in the same ways in which I am socially awkward, because in that we will become a society.
Right. Right.
And trying to pull that apart is immensely damaging. And I think that that's also part of what the movie's about, because it's enormously isolating that he feels like the only person that knows what's going on. And then She shows that she's the Clementine inside his mind because she says, it's almost it, Joel. This is the last one. And he says, I know. And she says, what do? And he says, I don't know. We enjoy it. But so there's no place left to go. And so there's the moment where she says the line at the beginning of their relationship. The last thing Clementine says to him in his mind is, this is it, Joel. Right. So he's sitting there. He's both original Joel and not original Joel. And he feels alone. But when she says what she says to show him that she's the projection of herself in his mind, they come together. And that's sort of how all relationships work. You feel isolated and somebody says something that you think that you were thinking. And no matter how weird it is, whatever you were thinking, the fact that you're both thinking it is you formed a little society.
Right. Right. And he faces it too. We talked about defending your life. Remember, he's watching the game show. He's going to face his fear. And that's kind of like what he ends up doing. He's like, well, we'll just enjoy it. Like, what am I going to do?
What's your moment?
So my moment is when it's actually about a word, and it's a word that the first time or two it was used in the movie, I thought to myself, I wonder if that's just a verbal tick or if it's deliberate. And of course it is deliberate. It's the word nice, and how Joel uses the word nice, and she says, I don't want nice. And they keep talking about the word nice. And that's such a great intro date word, right? You know, do you know so-and-so? Oh, she's really nice. Oh, he's really nice, right? The word nice. And it's great that that word carries all this emotional baggage, because this movie's very much about the emotional, the literal baggage, or maybe because this movie is about how there are objects that are infused with emotions that themselves are like the word nice. There's just junk objects that aren't worth anything financially, right? But they're worth something emotionally. And the word nice is one of them. Remember, one of her hobbies is she gets the potatoes. She makes like real potato heads. Like, that's just, they're not, she's not going to sell them. They're not worth anything, but they're worth something emotionally. And that's why I think it's so great that when you go to the Lacuna office, you sit there with your box of stuff. And if you've ever been handed a box of stuff back from somebody in a relationship, you know, a lot of people listening have been there. We've been there. And someone gives you, here's your box of stuff. Like, you know, when you're in high school, here's your varsity jacket. I don't want to wear this anymore, right? Those physical things are so imbued with emotional resonances. It's almost like they're radioactive. And the cool thing is that you try to forget somebody, but just forgetting the person isn't enough. You got to get the radiation off of all those objects and maybe all those words, or maybe it's a song that is now radioactive that you can't listen to anymore. Or maybe it's, you know, a movie that's radioactive. And the degree of erasing would be so complicated that it reminded me of It's a Wonderful Life. Jimmy Stewart gets erased from Bedford Falls. And then, so the angel has to show them how complicated it is. But, you know, Clarence the Angel, he's only scratching the surface, because if you really did have to erase him, there's so many intangibles out there. And I think this movie does a good job with that by showing that it's not just, you know, Jimmy Stewart wasn't alive to save his brother. So then the plane went down or the ships didn't sink. Like, it's about how, like, yeah, no, this potato head, you got to get rid of that too. What about this? You got to get rid of that too. Like, you'd never be done filling up the boxes.
Well, and so people say sentences like, this relationship just isn't working for me. And so you feel like there's a sense of autonomy outside of society. I am me. But it's like, well, how much of you is you? Because so much of you is essentially just rented to other people. And this is literally, like, if you thought about that spatially, this movie would be like you went house to house and you said, okay, you have to move out now. And you tried to take back the neighborhood. Now, in one sense, that's impossible. This movie is still obviously science fiction. In the other, though, if you were a 40-year-old man and you got asked by a 25-year-old, I feel like I keep dating the same person over and over. What should I do about that? It's like, well, you should know who you are. Mm-hmm. You got to fix you. And so I think that there's a definite tension between maturity and immaturity in the movie. And what immaturity says in a way makes sense, and what maturity says in a way makes sense, but there's an obvious spectrum, and neither, they're like two poles, and you can't exist at either one of them, because there's no real maturity. Because at the moment that you went back to take you, you'd realize that there is no you, that you as some kind of construction out of parts of your experience that are rented to and controlled by other people.
Other people's fingerprints are all over your stuff. So welcome back. In part 3, we talk about the title, and I know we're going to talk about Alexander Pope, or as she calls him, Pope Alexander. That's a great bit, Pope Alexander. We're going to talk about that quatrain, of course. But I also want to start this by talking about a question about the ending or about the movie overall. You ready? There's something that this movie doesn't really answer, or maybe it does answer it, and it doesn't do it fully. And here's what it is. You cannot watch this movie and not think to yourself if you would do it, right? That if you were in this movie, would you get it done? Mm-hmm. And then, of course, after the movie's over and you're cleaning the house later on, you start to think, okay, well, if I did get it done, who would I get erased? What would I do? Right. So if you've watched this movie and you've met your spouse in kindergarten and you've lived a complete Norman Rockwell existence, the movie won't work on you. You'll understand it in the abstract. The way that, like, when you're 14 and you watch a movie about marriage, you're like, I guess that's what it's like. But all of a sudden, then when you're married, all of those movies make a lot more sense. So you can't help but think, who would I get erased? But here's the thing the movie doesn't answer. If you could go back and erase a bad relationship from your life, because you're tired of thinking about it, or it was just awful, right? And you wouldn't be plagued by it. That's great. The movie doesn't then explain how that would affect your new personality, because we are the sum total of our experiences. And you know, without that bad relationship when you were 25, would you still be the same person when you were 35? Well, I would say no. And I'm not criticizing the movie for that, but that's like a whole other question that the movie doesn't really get into.
Yeah, but I think the implication that they continue to find each other despite the procedure is the answer, which is that the procedure doesn't work. Like, it kind of works, but it doesn't work. You know, what can you do with bad relationships, with bad experiences? You can paper them over so that experientially they are not part of your everyday existence, but they are there in the yous that you are when you're not actively thinking about it.
Right.
And the implication is that they're somewhere. So I think that the movie makes it clear that the procedure doesn't work as well as people think it works.
Yeah. Well, those things are somewhere like in our head. So we can look back on past relationships we've had and we can kind of cringe at the way we behaved. And then, you know, what's great. We look back at these things and we say, you know what, that was a rough time in my life, but I'm a different person now. And you are a different person now, like to some degree, like otherwise it's like defending your life again. Otherwise we're just going to keep using the same 5% of our brain. But the movie like never really, I mean, I guess like you said, like the process doesn't really work, but I thought that was an interesting thing. There's a famous quote by John Stuart Mill. He says, better to be Socrates dissatisfied than a pig satisfied. Right? So it's better to be Socrates dissatisfied than a pig satisfied. Or it's like the red pill on the Matrix. Like, how do you want to live? Do you want to live with a spotless mind? Do you want to have the eternal sunshine of the spotless mind? Or is it better to know, don't have the eternal sunshine, but you're a different and maybe better person because of that?
Sigmund Freud on his deathbed was offered narcotics. And he said, I prefer to think in agony. And I think that that's right. That's a life philosophy, that not just a moment. And so I think that the implication in the movie is that you don't have a choice. So you can think in agony or you can not think in agony, but they're obviously continue to find each other. And it's not necessarily in a 100% romantic way. It's not a Hollywood ending, although it's kind of a Hollywood ending, but not really, but it is.
Let's talk about the quotation. This is by Pope. He says, he's talking about the Vestal Virgins who have no contact with the outside world. He says, how happy is the blameless Vestal's lot? The world forgetting by the world forgot. Eternal sunshine of the spotless mind. Each prayer accepted and each wish resigned.
Of course, that's from Pope's version of Abelard and Heloise. Right. And so if you know what happened to Abelard, right, it's he had a part of himself erased. And dealt with the implications of that through the rest of his life.
Right. If only we could. So the point of the passage is, if only we could have the eternal sunshine of the spotless mind. In the poem, it says that. But I think the movie says, well, would you really want that? Or if you did want it, would it even work?
But it's unattainable.
Right.
I think that the ironic idea, that this is a deeply ironic title in that we aspire to that. We say, I wish that had never happened. But the you that wishes that it never happened is the you that went through it happening.
Yeah.
So you Right. And so to wish that would be an act of self-erasure.
And not only do we wish it, we say things I wish never happened, we pretend that it didn't, right? You say, well, what about, you know, what about, I'm over her. I'm over her. She doesn't bother anymore. I'm totally over it. I'm totally over it. We tell ourselves that we do have the eternal sunshine of the spotless mind with certain bad experiences, but do we, or is that just, are we kidding ourselves?
Well, what we do is we credit ourselves that because I know this now, if I went through that again, I would not do the same thing. And therefore, what I shall do is I'll create a bridge for myself over that painful experience from one side of it to the other, which is how I would act now if I went through the same thing. And so what we're really doing is just like a movie, we're self-editing,
yeah.
Which is literally what this movie's about.
Yeah, this movie reminded me of the movie Primer, but with like emotions. In Primer, that's a beautiful thought experiment of reliving the same experiences over and over. And as you know, in Primer, we did an episode on it, the guys lose control of that. Well, here, Jim Carrey and Kate Winslet have to keep reliving these things, but there's also a real emotional weight to them that there isn't in a fun time travel movie.
And because again, the first time they happened is the last time they happened, and we may relive them, we may try to edit them, but I think that the point of the lacuna experiment failing is that we cannot edit them. They are uneditable.
Thanks for listening, everybody. We hope you've enjoyed our conversation about Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. You could follow us on X at 15minfilm. You could also follow us where, Mike?
Letterboxd.
And of course, our website is on the New Books Network. If you go to the New Books Network, they've had a totally revamped website, which is really, really great. You can check out all of our episodes there or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks, everybody.
We'll see you next time.